So if you picture a classic Vincent van Gogh painting in your mind right now, what do you see?
Oh, usually it's the sunflowers, right?
Right, exactly. You're probably visualizing those swirling thick colors of a starry night, or that vibrant, almost aggressive yellow energy of the sunflowers, or maybe, I don't know, the intense stare of one of his dark, brooding self-portraits.
Yeah, and we tend to treat those canvases as these like timeless, permanent things.
Exactly, timeless.
Yeah.
But what if the masterpieces you see hanging in museums today are actually, well, chemically altered, like physically faded versions of what he actually painted?
Right.
And what if those changing, degrading colors on the canvas perfectly mirror his own deteriorating mental state?
I mean, we are so accustomed to viewing these paintings as permanent static objects of genius,
No, no.
sealed behind glass and preserved in
Yeah,
time.
totally.
But underneath that varnish, they are actually in this constant state of chemical decay. So for this deep dive, we are taking a look at a really fascinating stack of research today, including a highly technical scientific investigation from the University of Amsterdam.
Which is just wild stuff.
It really is. They basically put Van Gogh's Paris and Antwerp paintings under a microscope to analyze his organic red pigments. And, well, we are pairing that chemistry with psychological analyses of his personal letters to his brother, Theo.
It is a completely different way to look at art history, honestly. I mean, we are not just analyzing brushstrokes today. We're looking at the brutal economics of his palette, the incredibly volatile chemistry of his cheap paints, and the psychological desperation behind his most famous self-portraits.
Yeah, to really understand what is happening on the actual canvas, you have to understand his reality between, say, 1885 and 1888.
Right.
He moves to Antwerp and then to Paris, and he is absolutely desperate to become a quote-unquote professional
He
artist.
wants to make it.
Exactly. His letters from this time show this fierce ambition. He is constantly searching for better material, specifically writing about his hunt for a red pigment that was, in his words, warm-spirited as wine.
But his ambition was like completely at odds with his bank account
Oh, completely.
because he was entirely reliant on his brother, Theo, for his financial survival. When you read their letters, it was almost entirely Vincent updating Theo on his work and then immediately following it up with this plea for more money.
And Theo just patiently tries to keep him afloat.
Yeah. Because Vincent is always broke, he has to source his materials from suppliers like Pere Tanguy in Paris. Tanguy was a beloved figure. I mean, Vincent really liked him and would often trade his paintings just to get some basic supplies.
Right, the barter system.
But Tanguy was also notorious for selling really cheap, heavily diluted, poor quality paints. Vincent was also picking up supplies from a shop called Tacit et Lote, just always, always looking for a bargain.
And this financial reality, it dictates the literal foundation of his art. Because if you look at contemporary catalogs from major suppliers at the time, like Winsor and Newton, they show this massive price disparity between pigments.
Like, how big of a difference?
Huge! If you wanted vibrant, bold colors like a true cerulean blue or a brilliant cadmium yellow, you paid a serious premium.
Right.
But darker earth tones, like a pigment literally called lamp black, were incredibly cheap.
Okay, but look at his 1886 self-portrait with dark felt hat. He's using a very dark palette there. He has a deeply somber expression,
Yeah.
and he is wearing this heavy, dark green overcoat.
Yeah, that's a famous one.
Right. And we know he idolized peasant painters like Jean-François Millet and Jules Breton. I mean, he even painted copies of Millet's work, like The Woodcutter.
He did, yeah.
So couldn't we argue this dark, moody palette is purely a, a profound artistic choice to emulate his heroes? It just feels kind of like a modern indie filmmaker choosing to shoot a movie in gritty black and white. Is it really just about being broke, or is it a deliberate aesthetic?
Well, it is definitely a mix, but the historical evidence points really heavily to the economics. I mean, he certainly admired the peasant painters, but he was also acutely aware of his budget.
So it was just cheaper.
Exactly. Those cheap earth tones allowed him to paint constantly without going completely bankrupt. And that dark green overcoat in the painting,
Yeah.
that was not a carefully chosen wardrobe piece to convey some moody atmosphere. He painted himself wearing that specific coat multiple times simply because it was the only winter coat he owned.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, and he couldn't afford a new one.
He couldn't even afford to hire models either.
No, he couldn't. He painted endless self-portraits because, well, staring into a mirror was free.
Wow. So the shadows in his early work are literally cheaper than light.
That's a great way to put it.
But he didn't stay entirely in the dark. He moved toward those vibrant colors, especially the reds he was so obsessed with. And that University of Amsterdam study reveals exactly what was in those reds. The scientists used a technique called HPLC-PDA fluorescence detection to identify the exact colorants.
Which sounds very intimidating.
Right. Wait, before we get into the results, HPLC what? For those of us who aren't organic chemists, how are they actually identifying a 100-year-old molecule dried onto a piece of canvas?
So it stands for high-performance liquid chromatography, or HPLC.
Okay.
Imagine you have a mixed fruit smoothie, and you want to know exactly what fruits went into it.
Right, but it's already blended.
Exactly. So HPLC essentially forces that smoothie through a highly pressurized tube filled with a special filter material. Because strawberries, bananas, and blueberries all have different molecular weights and properties, they travel through that filter at different speeds, separating out one by one.
Oh, that makes sense.
Yeah, so the scientists take a microscopic flake of Van Gogh's paint, dissolve it into a liquid, and run it through this machine. The molecules separate, and the PDA and fluorescence detectors identify them based on how they absorb and emit light.
So they're basically unblending the smoothie to find the original ingredients.
Yeah.
And the ingredients they found on Van Gogh's palette are just wild. To get his reds, he used cochineal. That is a dye derived from crushed, wingless female insects from Central America that secrete carminic acid to deter predators.
Which is still used today, actually.
Yeah. Humans have been crushing them for centuries to get a brilliant crimson. He also used madder root and an extremely cheap pigment made from redwood. And the redwood contains a colorant called Brazilian, and the wood was actually imported into the Netherlands in large blocks.
And here's the crazy part about that wood.
Right, it was often given to prison inmates in Amsterdam to physically rasp and cut down into sawdust for dye making.
Prison labor, yeah. He was also experimenting with early synthetic dyes that were just hitting the market, like methyl violet. So when you look at his palette, you are really looking at a cross-section of 19th century global trade, natural biology, and early industrial chemistry.
It is a fascinating snapshot of the world, but it brings up a practical question. Whether the red comes from a crushed insect from Mexico or a block of wood rasped by a prisoner, once it is mixed with oil and slapped onto the canvas, paint is paint, right? Does the source actually matter?
Oh, it matters immensely, and it is the key to a massive chemical tragedy unfolding in museums right now.
A tragedy. How so?
Well, to achieve his signature impasto technique, you know, those thick, heavy, highly textured brush strokes that look almost three-dimensional on the canvas.
Right, the classic Van Gogh texture.
Exactly. He needed a very specific consistency of paint to do that.
Right.
He couldn't just use thin, runny dyes. So he favored a specific tin-based cochineal lake, and to bulk it up, the manufacturers mixed it with starch.
Like potato starch?
Usually wheat or potato, yeah. Mm. The researchers actually found microscopic starch grains measuring just 4 to 5 micrometers across embedded in the paint samples.
That's incredible.
The starch acted as an extender. It gave the paint this incredibly dense, fluid body. It was perfect for those heavy strokes and the fine, raised outlines he wanted. You can see this technique perfectly preserved in the physical texture of paintings like the courtesan and his self-portrait as a painter.
So it gave him the physical 3D texture he was famous for.
Yes, but chemically, this specific combination carminic acid from the insect, bonded to tin and extended with starch, was incredibly fugitive.
Meaning the color physically escapes.
Exactly. When you expose the specific molecular structure to light, particularly the ultraviolet rays in daylight, the photons physically attack the chemical bonds in the carminic acid.
Oh, no.
Yeah. The light breaks the conjugated double bonds that allow the molecule to reflect red light in the first place. The tin actually acts as a catalyst, accelerating this breakdown.
And the starch?
Well, because the starch dilutes the concentration of the pigment, there is less red there to begin with. Over decades of hanging in well-lit rooms, the red pigment doesn't just dull, its chemical structure is shattered. The color literally ceases to exist.
Which means the paintings we are looking at today are fundamentally different from what Van Gogh actually painted.
Vast areas of his canvases have physically changed. Van Gogh loved mixing this specific red with blue to create deep, vibrant violet backgrounds.
No.
But because the red has been chemically annihilated by light, those once saturated violets have degraded into insipid, pale, greenish grays.
So the sources mentioned baskets with violets on a stool and red cabbages and onions. If you look at them in a gallery today, the backgrounds just look like a slightly dreary blue-gray.
Right.
but researchers removed the frames and looked at the very edges of the canvas, like the quarter inch of fabric that has been hidden under paper tape or the frame's rebate, completely protected from light for over a century.
And what did they find?
Underneath that tape, the original deep, vibrant, aggressive purple is still perfectly intact. And in another piece, his self-portrait painted on cardboard designated as F356, he used thin background glazes of this red lake.
Yeah, that one is heartbreaking.
Today, those glazes have faded into complete, invisible transparency. You are just looking at bare cardboard.
It fundamentally alters the entire composition.
It is. It's like listening to a grand symphony, but the entire string section has been slowly muted over a century, and you are just sitting there listening to the brass, assuming that is what the composer intended.
That's a perfect analogy.
Think about the irony here. You have generations of brilliant art historians standing in galleries writing theses on Van Gogh's, quote, loose, unfinished background strokes. They analyze his brilliant avant-garde use of negative space.
Right, assigning all this meaning.
But they are analyzing a chemical disappearing act. The blue strokes are just floating there in empty space because the red they were originally mixed with simply vanished into thin air. They are assigning profound artistic intent to what is actually just cheap paint failing.
That is the great irony of art history colliding with organic chemistry. But it wasn't a universal failure. There's a battle of chemical stability happening right on the same canvas. Yeah, the UVA scientists found another pigment he used called Copse purpurin.
What is that?
It is an early synthetic pigment, and it has 50 to 55 times the tinting strength of traditional madder root.
Whoa.
It is incredibly potent, and more importantly, its molecular bonds are incredibly stable against UV light. In paintings like Glass with Yellow Roses, he applied Copse purpurin thickly, and it has kept its brilliant color beautifully.
So it didn't fade at all?
Not at all. In fact, its chemical structure is so robust that if you shine a UV light on it today, it literally fluoresces bright orange.
Sort of like how the quinine in tonic water glows bright blue under a black light at a bar.
Very similar mechanism, yeah. The molecule absorbs the UV light and releases it as visible energy instead of breaking apart. But returning to his economic struggles, pure Copse purpurin was expensive.
Of course it was.
He couldn't always afford to use it straight from the tube. The chemical analysis showed he would sometimes mix the stable, expensive synthetic with that cheap prison labor redwood lake just to stretch his supplies.
So you have a highly stable molecule mixed with a highly unstable one.
And the result is a mess. The Copse purpurin stayed vibrant, but the redwood strokes degraded terribly.
Did they fade too?
Worse, they didn't just fade into transparency. The organic material broke down and turned into crusty, brittle, yellow lumps sitting on the surface of the canvas.
Oh, gross. So his very canvas is deteriorating, which honestly parallels the next major shift in his life. Because we are moving from the physical degradation of his cheap paints to the brutal deterioration of his mental health.
Yeah, the fading canvas and his fraying mind are happening simultaneously.
We have to talk about the infamous Yellow House incident in the south of France.
Yeah.
He rents this house in Arles, hoping to create a utopian artist colony. He invites Paul Gauguin to live and work with him.
Which was a recipe for disaster.
Completely. The tension escalates rapidly.
Yeah.
They clash over their artistic philosophies. Their personalities completely grate on each other, and the environment becomes incredibly toxic. It culminates in Van Gogh allegedly threatening Gauguin with a razor and then horrifically mutilating his own ear, severing a portion of it, and presenting it to a maid at a local brothel.
It is arguably the most infamous psychological break in art history.
Yeah.
But what is truly revealing is how he used his art as a direct functional tool to navigate the immediate aftermath of that trauma.
Let's analyze self-portrait with bandaged ear, painted in January 1889. He paints himself in his studio. The bandage is prominent. But the writer Margaret Drabble points out a deeply unsettling detail.
The coat, right.
Exactly.
Right.
He is inside his own studio, presumably next to a stove, but he is wearing his heavy outdoor winter clothes, a thick, fluffy hat, and that same dark green overcoat we talked about earlier.
Right, from when he couldn't afford a new one.
Yeah. And she suggests this indicates a profound lack of permanence. He doesn't feel safe or at home, even in his own private sanctuary. He's bundled up as if he is ready to be cast out into the cold at any second.
He's bracing for eviction, both physically from the town of Arles and mentally from his own autonomy.
But wait, this brings up a massive contradiction in the painting.
Hmm.
I mean, we are told he is in the middle of absolute mental turmoil, recovering from self-mutilation and massive blood loss.
True.
Yet, his facial expression in the painting is entirely serene. He looks calm, lucid, and completely composed. And right over his shoulder, taking up a significant portion of the background, he deliberately paints a completely blank canvas sitting on an easel.
Yeah, it's very striking.
If he is spiraling into madness, why does he look so put together? And why highlight an empty canvas?
Because this specific painting was not a diary entry expressing his inner turmoil. It was a highly calculated, desperate legal and medical plea.
Wait, a plea to who?
To his doctors, specifically Dr. Ray, and to the local authorities. He painted this almost immediately after being discharged from the hospital.
Okay.
The local townspeople had petitioned the mayor to have him locked up permanently, calling him a public menace. He was terrified of losing his freedom.
Oh.
So he included the prominent bandage not to sensationalize his madness, but to prove his compliance.
Oh, I see.
Yeah, it shows he is accepting medical treatment and acknowledging his injury.
And the blank canvas.
It wasn't a symbol of a creative block or an empty mind. It was a deliberate message to the doctors that he was ready to put the chaotic past behind him and start fresh.
Wow.
It was a visual promise of future productivity. He literally invited doctors into his home specifically to look at this painting. He was using his technical skill to prove his mental equilibrium, hoping they would see the steady, precise brush strokes and conclude that a madman couldn't possibly paint with such control.
That is heartbreaking.
He was begging them to let him live independently.
It is a visual resume of sanity. He's painting for his life.
Yeah.
But it didn't work.
No, it didn't. The town continued to pressure the authorities, and his own paranoia and hallucinations returned. Despite this carefully constructed masterpiece proving his sanity, just a few months later, he voluntarily admitted himself to the St. Paul Asylum in Saramie.
Which, incredibly, is where he would look out a barred window and paint The Starry Night. He was entirely aware of his own decline. There was a deeply cynical, just heartbreaking line in one of his letters to Theo from this period.
What did he say?
When the locals ask about his health, he writes, "I'll begin by dying of it, and that afterwards my sickness will be dead."
God, that is the tragic clarity of his condition. He knew the illness was going to outlast his physical body. He knew he was losing the war.
So knowing his mind is failing and his paints are chemically self-destructing, what does this mean for his final works? Let's bring this all together with his late self-portrait from late 1889, painted while he was in the asylum.
Right. The contrast with his dark early Antwerp portraits is staggering.
Staggering. Here he is positioned right in the center of a bold, swirling blue impasto background that looks almost like a turbulent ocean.
He is wielding incredibly vivid colors. In a letter to Theo, he described his approach here as a marriage of complementary colors, their mingling and opposition. Even as his mind is fracturing, his command of color theory and technique is at its absolute peak.
And the symbolism in this painting is incredibly direct. He is prominently holding a wooden palette and a cluster of paintbrushes. But the detail from the sources that absolutely blew my mind is the paint on the palette itself.
The colors?
Yes. The dabs of color he paints on the wooden board in his hand are only the exact colors he used to paint the portrait we are looking at.
It is a deeply self-referential statement. When you connect this to the broader history of art, it echoes masters like Rembrandt, who also painted himself defiantly holding the tools of his trade in his later years.
I can see that.
Van Gogh is holding his brushes to demand the respect he was never given.
He is screaming his identity at the viewer. Society largely ignored him. His extended family was embarrassed by him. He relied entirely on his brother for survival.
Yeah.
And as we now know from the chromatography analysis in Amsterdam, the very materials he was using were literally crumbling, fading, and turning to crusty yellow lumps as he applied them to the canvas. Everything around him, his health, his finances, his materials, is failing.
Yet he used the only resource he had left, his technical brilliance, to assert his absolute undeniable worth as a painter.
Think about that for a second. When the world strips away every ounce of your validation, when your mental health is collapsing, and the literal tools you rely on are actively fading away in your hands, how do you paint your own worth into existence?
Right.
He forced the world to look at him, even if it took a century for us to truly see it.
It is the ultimate act of defiance against a world that was entirely hostile to his existence.
So to recap the incredible ground we have covered on this deep dive, we started with the brutal economics of poverty, forcing a desperate artist to mix crushed insects, potato starch, and prison-cut wood just to get a vibrant red. We saw how the volatile chemistry of those cheap materials, attacked by ultraviolet light, led to disappearing backgrounds and altered masterpieces. and we track the shift from his fading canvases to his fraying mind, culminating in a severed ear, a desperate legal plea painted on a canvas, and a final defiant fight for legitimacy.
It completely reframes his legacy. He wasn't just a tortured genius throwing paint at a wall.
Not at all.
He was a deeply intentional artist, fighting a war of chemical attrition on a molecular level with his paint and a psychological war with his own mind.
And that brings us to a final lingering thought for you to ponder long after this deep dive ends. Now that scientists have the exact molecular breakdown, like down to the precise formulation of the tin cochineal, the microscopic starch grains, and the Kopp's purpurin, we technically possess the digital and even physical tools to restore his paintings.
We really do.
We could reconstruct them, reversing the chemical decay, and return these masterpieces to the garish, bright, hyper-vivid original colors Van Gogh actually saw when the paint was wet.
We have the technology to undo a century of fading.
But should we? Or is the tragic chemical decay of those cheap paints, the fading away of the bright purples into something more muted, somber, and gray, now an essential part of the masterpiece?
That's a big question.
Is the physical deterioration of the canvas a perfect, poetic reflection of the deteriorating man we have come to revere? Do we want the bright, scientifically accurate Van Gogh, or the one fading beautifully into the blue-gray? Thank you for joining us on this deep dive. Remember, whether you are looking at a priceless painting in a museum or analyzing the complicated life of the person who painted it, there is always, always more beneath the surface.